Hi, this is Joe Aguirre, Average Joe, thanking you for listening to our podcast. We'd love to hear what you think. Just take a few minutes, maybe 5 minutes, visit our website at reasons.org/survey, and give us your thoughts. We'd appreciate it. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is brought to you by Reasons to Believe. Reasons to Believe is a science-faith think tank integrating modern scientific discoveries with truths of the Bible. Visit our website at reasons.org.
Welcome to a special edition of I Didn't Know That. This is Joe Aguirre along with Drs. Hugh Ross and Jeff Zwierink and our guest, climatologist Kevin Birdwell. This is part two of this four-part series with Kevin on climate change. We'll pick it up where we left off on the last program. Kevin, you've been talking about these features as you have been answering questions, but I want to get a more deliberate explanation for lay listeners. Can you talk about what the AMO, PDO, and ENSO mean as it relates to climate change?
Sure. One of the things that's overlaid on top of this warming and cooling I just talked about is the fact that we have these decadal oscillations in the ocean sea surface temperatures. And they're very important in driving our climate. In fact, even if we were to say, let's just accept that, you know, all the global greenhouse gas warming is going on that is claimed, it's really not that much of a direct effect. It's in terms of our medium-term climate, like annual variation and decadal variation, it's really being driven by the oceans. Whatever heat the oceans are receiving or not receiving, then that's getting transferred over to the land. So it's really, I think, better to look at it from an ocean perspective. But you have probably one of the most important oscillations in the Northern Hemisphere is the Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation. And what's challenging about the AMOs, it's called, is that it's been very hard to predict. Only in the last 2 years or 3 years of literature have I seen something that looks like we're beginning to get some predictive ability on it. And it appears to be related to the what's called the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC, which is basically the related to the global conveyor belt of ocean currents. And what the Atlantic does is it basically transports huge amounts of heat from around the globe, something on the order of 10 to the 15 watts, north through the Atlantic all the way to the subpolar Atlantic near the area of Iceland and Norway and almost to the Arctic. And this is where water sinks and then recirculates at depth around the world. And this AMOC, as it's called, is a circulation that varies in time. It has natural variability on the scale of centuries and smaller cycles even. And it seems to be related to the activity of the AMO. The AMO, when it's in a positive phase, it implies warm sea surface temperatures. And it basically, we're talking about a plus or minus, typically it's plus or minus 0.5 degrees Celsius, but certainly I think the last warm phase of the AMO has been stronger, had more of a rapid increase in temperature. We were in a negative AMO phase around really from the 60s until about 1994, and the Atlantic Ocean rapidly went to a warm phase at that point. If you notice, there was
a negative phase is where there's this circulation is causing the surface temperatures to be cooler and as a result cooling the globe. Is that what that means?
It seems to have, the North Atlantic seems to have a large influence on the temperatures of the Northern Hemisphere.
Right, okay.
But especially North America and Europe.
Right, okay.
And certainly in the area that I'm in, I can see a really strong correlation when I look at temperatures on, say, a decadal scale. Now, year to year, it might vary for other reasons.
Right.
But overall, it's going to follow that pattern.
How well do we know that? Presumably we can make some measurement of what this current is, you know, in current times. How well do we understand the history of, you know, the AMO, for example?
Well, it's fairly well established in the 20th century.
Okay.
I've seen some recent theoretical modeling that basically showed that it was, you know, a real circulation and that it was related to the deep ocean. The modeling suggested that 80% of the phases are about 10 to 15 years in length. Now, the ones that we've had in the last century have tended to be a bit longer than that. I think they've been enhanced by, you know, for example, the increasing solar radiation in the early 20th century, and maybe that lengthened it. But what very recent research is showing, and a lot of these are things from like 2009 and even 2010, is that the AMO seems to be directly related to the phase and strength of the deep water circulation there. And that what's important about that is that we may be actually going through another transition right now. And honestly, this was a little bit of a surprise to me because...
Transition meaning?
Well, we went to a warm phase in the mid-90s, and just based on the last few warm phases, I was kind of thinking, well, this might last a bit longer. But the AMO, which, you know, as far as we know, is based on the AMOC, is trending toward a negative phase again. It's
okay.
Not quite there, but it seems to be on its way. And if that continues, then that implies that we're going to have a potential for as much as a 1C cooling relative to all the other forcings in the areas around the Atlantic very soon. And that very well may have been a reason why we had a much colder winter recently.
Mm-hmm.
There is an association with that kind of pattern and a cool AMO phase.
On somewhat of a somewhat tangential topic, if this circulation or the circulation overturn current this ocean circulation kind of grinds to a halt, how big a deal is that? Does that happen in recorded history that we're aware of, or is this sort of thing that it doesn't change on tens or hundred thousands of years, or is this a 1,000-year time scale, 100-year, or do we know?
The last time it basically ground to a halt was during the last glacial period, and then it came back.
Which is, 10,000 years ago?
Right.
Or better?
Okay. At the end of that period, it came back to life, but then there was a brief turnaround where it collapsed again, and that led to the Younger Dryas period, which was about a 1,000-year period where conditions nearly returned to glacial temperatures.
Okay. And how do we know that?
Out of it.
How do we know that this ocean circulation has been going on?
Well, prior to instrument record times,
right,
there are proxy records we can look at. Basically ocean, all kinds of the relationship between isotopes in the oceans and probably even in some cases deposits and the behavior of animal species in the ocean, things like that. But
well, would this show up in
isotopic evidence is probably one of the biggest ones.
Now, would this show up in sediment core drills and ice core drills?
It should, yes, because it would create major changes in both temperature and precipitation, and so then you can look at things like oxygen isotopes. You know, most oxygen is O16, but there's a heavy isotope that's O18. And so, for example, they look at the relationship between those ratios of those two to see whether we were in a warm period or a cold period or a wet period or dry period, depending on where you are. That's one of the things that they look at, for example, in the Greenland ice sheet.
So we look at proxies of things we measure in various ice cores and speleothems, those sorts of things that measure that are a way to get a handle on whether this ocean circulation has been going, but just because of how strongly it affects the climate.
Going to a negative AMO phase, we're not talking about shutting it down. We're just talking about slowing it down, basically. And you could say that a lot of the heat that's generated in the southern hemisphere, you know, the southern hemisphere gets about 6% more solar radiation than the northern hemisphere. a lot of that heat gets transferred to the northern hemisphere via this circulation.
Right.
And one of the things that's peculiar in terms of climate change about the AMOC recently is that it it goes through these strengthening phases and declining phases, and according to the predictions that have recently been developed, it's probably about to start declining. It's probably at a maximum right now, but or maybe just past it. But it the increase that's happened over the last, say, decade or two as we went through this warm phase was really dramatic. In fact, the warming that it caused, it appears to have caused, extra, really brought a lot of extra heat into the Arctic Ocean, more than what might be expected.
Okay.
And the Barents Sea, for example, which is just north of, in the region of Norway, the warming that's happened there is basically unprecedented as far as the climate proxy record is concerned. So, to me, that's an example of something that suggests that something different's been going on in the last few decades than maybe a little more than just the normal oscillation. But that also could explain that extra warm water coming from the AMOC could probably explain at least partially the sea ice melt that we've been seeing in the Arctic in the last few decades. That may not explain all of it, but it does probably explain some of it. I know a lot of the sea ice has been melting from below as well as from above, and the AMOC could certainly help explain that. It's also interesting to note that most of the melting that's occurred in Greenland has been, not all of it, but I'd say maybe as much as 40 or 50% of it, is on that southeastern side of Greenland, which is most exposed to that area of warm water.
Uh-huh.
Is coming in. So if that circulation begins to weaken just naturally, it will probably at least slow down its influence on the melting for the short term.
So weakening means that it's going to transport less heat from the southern atmosphere up to here, or southern hemisphere up to here, which will minimize some of the warming effects, at least for the northern hemisphere.
That's correct. And you really don't want to completely shut it down. If you completely shut it down, Europe might get 5 degrees Celsius cooler.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, that sounds fairly drastic. So.
Now,
if I remember, or if I understood your comment correctly, while this the AMOD and the PDO, or the AMO and the PDO, and we're proliferating acronyms here, but those have a dramatic effect on, or of dramatic in the sense that it can explain a lot of the temperature variations we've seen, or the heating and the cooling we've seen. Do we know whether those are affected by human activity or not?
I think at this point we can't say for sure. Now we can say that global warming models, most of them, do predict that the AMOC will the ocean current will weaken, not shut down, but will weaken by as much as, I'd say the average prediction is probably 30%, if we have all the anticipated global warming. And so that is a prediction that the models make. So while its decline in the next few years wouldn't necessarily prove that point, if the decline was maybe more than anticipated over the next decade or two, then that might provide some evidence in favor of that model, and that is going to have an influence.
Okay,
that,
so
that
as
have an that would have a cooling influence on the North Atlantic region.
So our influence on the the circulation or the overturn current is based on how much we warm things up, because that affects the circulation. Or am I missing what you're saying?
Well, I believe it's. It's related. I don't really understand all the ways in which the warming is supposed to affect the slowdown of the current. This is, but it is one of the predictions of the global climate models. But I suspect it's probably tied in to the tropical Pacific. All of these ocean basins communicate with each other, in a sense, through what's called Rossby waves. And in the Pacific, you've got Kelvin waves along the equator. Basically, these are slow-moving wave motions that communicate changes to each ocean basin. And also, the climate models predict that in a global warming environment, you would have greater El Nino. I don't want to say greater El Ninos, but the state of the Pacific Ocean would be more on the warm phase of the El Nino phenomenon.
Okay.
So that is another prediction of most of the models, and you know, that's what makes me a little curious that we are seeing, or at least up through the 90s, we saw the 80s and 90s, we saw a big increase in El Ninos, and even in this decade where things have settled down a bit, we still had six El Nino years.
Now, does it predict more El Ninos, or does it predict that they will be more extreme, or does it predict both?
I don't know that it necessarily predicts they'd be more extreme. First of all, it's probably better if we look at El Nino as a instead of an episodic event, look at it more of as an event that's just an oscillation. And what it's basically predicting is that the warm phase would be more dominant in a warmer world instead of the La Nina. And basically, what El Nino is the shifting of the warm pool in the Pacific, which is traditionally in the western North Pacific and in the area east of Indonesia. In an El Nino, that's the normal state, but in an El Nino state, some of that warm pool shifts toward South America. And so that change, that movement of that warm water has global implications for the way climate changes. I know that here we normally see a 1 degree Celsius increase in our average annual temperature when we're in a significant El Nino event. However, and here's where it just keeps getting more complicated, that is modulated by the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which is another oscillation in the Pacific that's separate from El Nino, and that operates on time scales of like 40, 50, 60, 70 years. And the Pacific Decadal Oscillation was also in a warm phase, at least as far as North America is concerned, up until the year 2000, and then it went to a cool phase. So now that we're in a cool phase, I know from some climate studies that we probably won't have as much influence from El Nino as we did, at least in the eastern U.S., as we did in the period prior to that. Now, in the western U.S. where you are, you probably will have more influence from El Nino in a Pacific cool phase.
So there's nothing directly we do that influences these circulations or oscillations. It's more as we influence, if we influence the global climate, these kind of amplify that effect. Is that correct?
That is very possible.
Okay, that's the which is different from, you know, the carbon dioxide discussion, because there we directly generate carbon dioxide.
Right, but I think there's probably been too much focus on the direct effects of carbon dioxide, and we really should be looking at what are the indirect effects. How do things affect circulation changes and patterns like this, because ultimately these are what drives our year-to-year weather patterns. So
I would concur with that these are a bigger concern that we need to be aware of. So
it sounds like bottom line what you're saying, Kevin, is that these detailed climate models that we have do generate predictable results that can be tested on a relatively short-term basis. Is that correct?
To some extent, that's true. Mostly what has been done in that regard is they will model the past climate of, say, the last 100 years or 50 years and try to match things up
with
that. And they've had some measure of success with that. Now, what I guess really kind of confuses me about that, though, is the fact that as I said earlier in the recent literature, some of these, it appears we may have been overemphasizing CO2 a little bit and maybe underemphasizing things like carbon soot. I've seen at least one paper I read recently where they tried to take that into consideration, but they hadn't revised the values of, let's say, carbon soot. and yet they still came out with, you know, reasonably good results. I think in this case they were comparing the 1940s to the 1990s. Now, I did notice they had some problems with their standard deviation on, say, their the solar part of it.
I guess a question I would have is, you know, if you're modeling something on the time scale of 100 years, but yet you have these oscillations that can happen at the 50, 60, 70 year time scale, that seems far too short, unless if that's just something you're putting directly into the model.
Well, that is a good point, because I think it's generally realized that at the moment the models really do not take into proper account the decadal oscillations I'm talking about.
Okay.
I know, for example, they make the AMOC ocean current a little too stable.
Okay.
So, in other words, the real world, it fluctuates a lot more than the models want to make it do. So, there's definitely issues with the models. That's one of the issues with the models. Another issue with the models, which we really haven't gotten into yet, is cloud cover.
Right.
Cloud cover has an influence, just to give you a perspective, it's on the order of 28 watts per meter squared.
Which compares
to a global warming greenhouse gas forcing of something like 2 watts or 3 watts.
So the cloud covers,
that's
the
big
dominant effect then, it almost seems.
Yes, there's an awful lot of radiation that is moved around by clouds, and both to warm the earth and to cool the earth, and that is an area that's improving, but still needs some work. Now, probably on a global scale, you know, the numbers aren't that far off, but in terms of the local and regional scale, which is really where the emphasis needs to move, it could have a huge impact.
Wait a second. So on a global scale, we have the base, or you're saying we have the basic cloud cover. We do it right on average, but on a local scale, we don't have near the sensitivity that we need to have to that, or near the precision
absolutely
we have with that.
And that's an educated guess, even on the global scale. I think the best estimate I've seen is probably has a. Overall, it has gotten cloudier from the 50s to the present, which is maybe an average negative forcing of about 1.7 watts, but the standard deviation on that is like 1 watt, so you can see how much uncertainty there is there.
Yeah, because if we're talking, I mean, the errors on that are almost as big as the effect we're talking.
Yes.
Okay.
But you really can't look at it on a 50-year scale. You know, I've got some charts that show decadal or even annual cloud cover, and you can see that, you know, starting in the 80s, it declined until about the mid-90s.
The amount of cloud cover you're saying now?
Right.
Okay.
And then increased since then. So the cloud cover, the increase that's occurred in this decade has probably increased our albedo by at least a few percent, or the reflectivity of the Earth's surface.
My question would be, in the context of this discussion of, okay, we've got, you know, being able to reproduce these decadal oscillations and not having the cloud cover, or that being at least the error bars on that being as large as the effect we're saying is what we have to be worried about with the carbon dioxide, at some level, the question is, what good are the models? I mean, that sounds overly negative, but if there's that large of sources of error in them, what function do they serve?
I think they do serve some function, because they provide us with a lot of what if scenarios, and to their credit, they have made a lot of progress in improving them. Now, I do a lot of modeling. Or a lot of input to models each year for environmental compliance modeling. In other words, modeling pollutants to make sure that we're complying with the Clean Air Act laws here in Oak Ridge. And those models, you know, as an example, while they're not anything the scale of a global climate model, you are modeling a relatively long period of time, an entire year or maybe 5 years. And what you see is that most of the data kind of washes out. Most of the extremes wash out one way or the other. And that's probably true with the global climate models as well. However, it's still a bit of a problem in the sense that really there's probably too much emphasis on global scale consequences rather than regional or local scale, because nobody lives global scale. And of course, you know, if these things affect atmospheric circulation, then regional scale is really what you want to see. What are things doing there? Now, as I said, they're getting better, but they still have a ways to go, definitely as far as multi-decadal oscillations and definitely as far as cloud cover.
Well, a question that's often raised, Kevin, is the warming of the globe. Does that lead to more extreme local conditions or less extreme local conditions?
Well, my best estimate on that, based on, again, some what I've seen and read and even from what I've observed here locally, is that your maximum temperatures, let's say your maximum extreme temperatures, those would probably go up to the same amount that with the same amount of your warming. So like if you had a 2C warming, then your extremes would probably be 2C higher. But on the low end, it's a little different. The low end comes up more rapidly. So I'm trying to remember here. I think that in the Arctic, for example, what they've observed is that on the high end, it kind of follows that pattern I just mentioned, but on the low end of temperatures, it's about a 40% greater increase than on the high end. And that's probably related to water vapor and carbon dioxide feedbacks. One of the things I've noticed, for example, locally, is that as the temperatures increased in the last few decades here, which mostly that happened in the 90s, and it was about a 1 degree C increase here. Again, I would say that most of that's probably related to the AMO. But nevertheless, it would still have the effect of increasing the water vapor in the atmosphere. And also, when you have increasing CO2, it creates these long-wave feedbacks back to the Earth's surface, so that at night, when the Earth's surface is driving the cooling, you get warmer low temperatures relative to your high temperatures. All the warming that I've seen in Oak Ridge, two-thirds of it is minimum temperature. The maximums haven't changed as much. In fact, in some months of the year, the maximums haven't changed at all. And that's the kind of pattern they've been seeing in the Arctic, except more so.
Yeah, and for the benefit of the layperson, water vapor is a greenhouse gas.
Yes.
It's not that strong of a greenhouse gas, but there's a whole lot of it in the atmosphere. And so changing that by a small amount can make a big difference.
It makes up, it depends on how you characterize it as water vapor or clouds or whatever, but it's, you know, basically creating probably a 30C greenhouse effect. You know, if we didn't have a greenhouse effect, our average annual global temperature would be like zero Fahrenheit. So.
Okay, so.
And what we're really talking
about.
So we
go from zero Fahrenheit and we're up around. What is our average temperature?
Globally, it's probably around 15 C.
You changed on me. 15, so that'd be
59 Fahrenheit.
Yeah,
69 Fahrenheit. Okay.
Okay, that's nice to know. 69.
Yeah, and a question you brought up earlier, Kevin, about the carbon soot, how it has in some contexts a cooling effect and some a warming effect.
Yes.
Do we have a good measure on? How much more warming we get than the cooling from a carbon soot?
Probably not. A lot of the research on that is very recent. One of the more, the one that's gotten probably the most attention that I've seen recently is the one about the Himalayas. The Himalayas have been observed to be, the glaciers there have been observed to be melting, and again, looking at the paleo climate records, it appears to be an unprecedented event. But what they're discovering is that at least 50% of that 1C warming that has caused this is probably related to the carbon soot that's hanging in the area. The carbon soot, now it shields, for example, the Indian Ocean and may cause it to be cooler, but in terms of the atmosphere where the soot is hanging around, it's warming the atmosphere. And so that air is moving over the Himalayas and causing this effect. Now, there may be some greenhouse effect gas involved in that, but the carbon soot seems to be maybe the dominant signal. Same thing in the Arctic. They've traced 80% of the carbon soot to sources outside of the Arctic, and it's estimated to have three times the effect. But, of course, in the Arctic, what's happening there is it's falling on the snow, and it's just a few parts per billion increase in the soot on the snow causes a great deal of melting, and then that causes changes in the albedo of the surface once the snow and ice is gone. So all that kind of piles up. As an example, and that's probably one of the places that's warmed up the most in the Arctic, but Barrow, Alaska, I was looking at their records recently, and they've probably easily had a 2 to 3 degree Celsius warming in the last 50 years. But one of the other things I noticed there was that their precipitation has doubled, and that's mainly because the Arctic Ocean is now more ice-free there, so you get a lot more moisture advection and storms coming through there, and a lot more snowfall, actually.
And you're also implying that carbon soot on snow and ice has a much more dramatic effect than if it falls on green vegetation?
Probably so, yes.
Or on asphalt,
right, for sure.
That's going to do it for this second installment of a four-part series with climatologist Kevin Birdwell. Thanks to our producer, Jimmy Duke. We'll continue our discussion on the next podcast. Be sure to listen. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @RTB_official. Until then, this is Joe Aguirre for Hugh Ross and Jeff Zwierink, thanking you for listening and inviting you to join us for the next edition of I Didn't Know That.
This podcast is made possible through support from individuals like you. To learn more about supporting Reasons to Believe, go to www.reasons.org/donate or call 800-482-7836.